You heard the blank check that Caleb gave me, by the way. I can go as long as I want, and we get to blame him. Yeah, it's wonderful. So.
You can blame me.
I have all these excuses. It's great. Ah, okay. There we go. Thank you. Once again, I'll seek to be chaste with our content that we're dealing with. I've mentioned each week that, you know, this isn't necessarily my favorite topic in the world, but this, tonight, is my favorite of the three. Like, this is what I was most looking forward to getting to, was the pastoral implications and the church's response. Anyway, here's where we've been driving toward, the practical application. Just to remind you where we've been, right? Week one, our present cultural moment. Last week was the biblical perspective or biblical pushback. And then tonight, well, how should the church respond? Recall once again the three groups that we've been talking about, because different response for each group, and I think it's just helpful to keep that in our mind. The first group, those who would actually experience gender dysphoria, uniquely uncomfortable in their own bodies, feeling out of accord with their own gender, usually starting around the age of two, pretty persistent and very, very rare, right? 1 in 10,000 boys, 1 in 20,000 girls, so incredibly rare. And then we talked about the second group, the activists, those who are pushing the predatory ideology in our culture, seeking to kind of dismantle women's safe spaces, especially and particularly aimed toward young women, teen girls, and so the need to stand against the activists. And then the third group, those who are being inflicted with this predatory ideology, the sufferers, those who are most at risk. And again, so different response, different group. Just want to keep those three groups in our mind. Just very briefly to revisit Ryan Anderson's book. Last week I summarized his main arguments, right? But I just wanted to point to his subtitle again. When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment. And I don't intend to summarize his argument again or point to his argument again. But he really does see this as just a moment, just one stop of many stops on a particular train that is going somewhere. And he doesn't ultimately make an argument where it's going, but he's saying this is not the end. This isn't the objective. This isn't the goal where the activists are trying to run the ball. This is not where they're trying to bring matters. This is just one stop among many, or one goal among a larger, you know, battle plan or something like that. I'm going to point to Carl Truman's book in just a moment, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, where he also sees this as just a moment. This is not the end result. Carl Truman suggests that one day our culture will wake up and see the insanity of cross-gender bathrooms and the insanity of transgender sports. But since Truman has written his book, he's come out a little bit more clearly of where this agenda is going. And independently, Carl Truman and I have arrived at the same conclusion. So I've arrived, right, if I've come to the same conclusion as Carl Truman. But I want to make the case of where this is going. This is not a moment that will reverse. It's not like we can get the toothpaste back in the toothpaste tube now that it's been squeezed out. And actually, our goal shouldn't be to try and jam the toothpaste back in the tube. I actually think that's a misfocus of what the church should be about and what we should be seeking to do. Now, this is one offensive after the next offensive in the deconstruction of reality, of what is taking place, that really our culture is seeking to dismantle the work of God. And so if you'll reflect back to 1950s, the sexual revolution hasn't been walked back. Right now, the sexual revolution is passé. in our culture. It's not as though like we got that toothpaste back in that tube, and it's not going back. No, the sexual revolution was to run the ball in deconstructing the Judeo-Christian sexual ethic. Job accomplished by our culture. Well, then fast forward to the 1980s, 90s, and early 2000s with the homosexual agenda. And now the homosexual movement is, once again, passé. It's not as though we're going to rewind that and retake that particular area with regard to our culture. If you recall, the argument of the homosexual agenda of born that way, the particular ideology that was being advanced at the time, it was an indefensible position, and it's been entirely abandoned. Brian Anderson makes the same argument in his book about the transgender movement, that the transgender activists recognize the position is indefensible and already has like an embattled defensive posture, which reveals the fact that it's not long for the argument, not long for our culture. But anyway, back to the homosexual agenda. Again, it is passé. Allow me to use another illustration along these lines as far as what our culture is seeking to do. Think about the abortion issue, the indefensible position that the child growing in the womb is not actually a human being, or that life begins at conception, or life does not begin at conception. It's an ideologically indefensible position that if you're aware of the pro-choice argument today, those positions have been abandoned. They're no longer arguing that it's not a human being or that life does not begin at conception. Instead, the argument is, yes, it's a human body, but it's not a human person. They've not reached personhood intellectually in their awareness. And so back to the Nancy Piercy argument we were talking about in the first week. Anyway, all of this to say is that the transgender moment is just a moment. It's an ideology that will be abandoned once it has accomplished its cultural aims. And the cultural aims are the destruction of the image of God in man, the destruction of gender. If we think back again to the sexual revolution, the aim was the destruction of monogamy. The homosexual agenda, the destruction of heterosexuality. And with the transgender movement, the destruction of gender itself. So what's the objective? What's the target? What's the aim? I want to play a clip from the BBC mini-series back in 2019-2020, so I know that's kind of passé now. It's 3 years old. It's so funny, in my classes that I teach, anytime I use an illustration that's like 4 or 5 years old, like I feel like embarrassed, like, oh no, it's old, it's an old illustration. So it's just funny how quickly things move and change. But anyway, this is from the BBC mini-series called Years and Years. It's a dark comedy. I'm just curious, because the answer is always the same in every group I present this. Has anybody heard of Years and Years or seen Years and Years? Right, that's, oh, really? Okay, you're the first. Okay, we'll talk. the first person I've met who's actually acknowledged that. But anyway, so it's a transhumanism plot and a dark comedy. Let me just play this clip. What you have is you have a biracial husband and wife, mother and father, as they're talking to their daughter about how she's trans. So let me play this clip.
I think I've been uncomfortable for a very long time.
We know.
I've been thinking ever since I was born that I don't belong in this body.
It's really okay, darling.
I've been reading up on it. And I think I'm trans.
Oh, sweetheart. Oh, it's all right, darling. I swear.
It really is. Have a look at us. We're fine. We're completely fine, aren't we? I know we might be a bit slow and a bit old, and this is going to be confusing for us, and we'll make a mess of it sometimes, but we love you.
We love you. We absolutely love you. We always will. I mean, we don't need to rush. We've got lots of time to talk about this.
And you know, if it turns out that we've got a lovely son instead of a lovely daughter, then we'll be happy.
No, I'm not transsexual.
Oh.
Is that not the word now?
But you said trans.
What did we call you then?
I'm not transsexual. I'm transhuman.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. They keep changing the words. I don't know the difference.
I don't want to change sex.
No, sure. We say gender now, don't we? Sorry.
I said I'm not comfortable with my body, so I want to get rid of it. This thing. All the arms and legs and every single bit of it. I don't want to be flesh. I'm really sorry, but I'm going to escape this thing and become digital.
What do you mean?
They say one day, soon, they'll have clinics in Switzerland where you can go and you'll sign a form and they'll take your brain and download it into the cloud.
And your body?
Recycled. Into the earth.
So you want to kill yourself?
I want to live forever. As information, because that's what transhumans are, Mum. Not male or female. Better. Where I'm going, there's no life or death. There's only data. I will be data.
All right, so you hear the eschatology. You hear the hope. You hear the religion in it. I hope you also hear the satanic agenda. That the agenda is not gender. And even in satire, they're connecting transgenderism and transhumanism. They see the connection. The end game is the absolute destruction of the image of God and man, the destruction of the human being, the destruction of personhood. And I said that I would mention in just a moment Carl Truman and the rise and triumph of the modern self. He did make the argument in the book that it's just a moment, and since publishing the book, he has acknowledged, yes, the agenda is not gender, it is transhumanism. Transhumanism is the overarching battle lines. So if we think about the battle lines of a bygone era, the battle lines are no longer that of the sitcoms of the 1990s. If you remember the sitcoms of the 1990s were with Frasier and Friends and Seinfeld, for those of you who are familiar with those things, what was being poked fun at was promiscuity and fornication and adultery. That's a bygone era. Or, you know, the times of flagrance and promiscuity of Baywatch. Those days are gone. That cultural moment is gone. And let's not think back to previous cultural times and think, if only we could go back there, if only we could get back to the golden age of the 1950s or something, because Solomon would remind us from Ecclesiastes 7:10, it's not from wisdom that we ask such things. Why were the former days better than these? It's not from wisdom that you ask such things, as Ecclesiastes says. Instead, the battlefront is much more sinister, it's much more progressed, the destruction of sexuality itself, the degradation of the body, mutilating oneself in the name of freedom and identity. So as we think about then that, if that's the battlefront, then our call as the church is not a few things. And it's helpful for us to see what the call is not so that we can maybe clearly see what the call is. The call is not to whatever the current culture war is. I'm not saying we shouldn't speak in the public market space and we shouldn't speak in a forward-facing way. I'm not saying let's just keep our heads in the sand and be silent. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that the current battle is not the culture war, because it's going to shift, it's going to change, it's going to constantly progress, it's going to be different. And once you feel like you have some ground in a particular battle, then it'll just move to a different front. Now, in all of these points, I'm not speaking against the value of these things. So don't hear this in an ultimate way. I'm just saying these aren't our primary objectives. And so the call is not to get married and have a bunch of kids to flood the public square with godly offspring, to have enough to be able to overcome, you know, the flood of, you know, liberalism or whatever the case may be. I am pro-kid. Let's have children. Yes, indeed. Let's raise them up to be arrows shot against, you know, the kingdom of darkness, as Psalm 127 would have us to do. But that's not the primary objective that we're being called to here. I'm pro-voting, like vote, but that's not our goal. That's not our primary goal. Is if we just get the vote out, that will be able to stem the tide. It's also not to have better PR or better ad campaigns or better marketing. If the church could just do these things better, then we would be able to stem the tide. You know, if people want to put up billboards that speak against certain things and they have the resources to do so, well, that's fine. I mean, the Lord can use those things. I'm just saying that's not our primary objective. And then for those of you who are familiar with the Benedict option, there are some who are advocating, well, let's just circle the wagons. Let's just go back to kind of a monastery type mentality. We're not winning at the culture, and so let's just give up entirely and wait for a better time and a better cultural moment. Well, then that just removes the church's voice altogether, and I don't think that that's our call either. We have to remember that our battle is not against flesh and blood, and our weapons, the weapons of our warfare, are not carnal, and we have been given particular weapons. And so, let's use those particular appropriate weapons, the gospel. Let's continue to hold out the gospel, that timeless message that speaks to all cultural moments, regardless of what the cultural moment of our day, the cultural moment du jour happens to be. The gospel is always relevant. And so let us continue to speak biblical truth in contrast to whatever our culture is running after right now. And church, let's be about the work that the church has always been about, of holding out the true Christ in the face of all of the antichrists that are offered. The spirit of Antichrist has been at work in this world since at least the time of the apostles. And so, church, let's continue to hold out the true Christ, right? Let's hold the line on the truth. And let us know our primary battle is not the culture wars and not trying to just take back our culture from the ideologues. Instead, we continue to preach the true alternative that has always been an alternative. Let's preach clearly from the pulpits. So far as the Lord gives us opportunity, let's speak in the public square. Let's speak to our friends and our families and our neighbors. Let's stand against the predatory ideology so far as we are able. But let us not be surprised that 1 John 5:19 is true, that the world is under the sway of the evil one, and that the activists and ideologues don't care and don't want to hear. And let's not be surprised at that. But let us not forget compassion and care of those who are the victims of this wicked ideology. The church needs to continue to minister the compassion of Christ, the rehabilitation of Christ, the refuge that Christ is. Christ speaks in Matthew 19 about eunuchs, that there are those who are born eunuchs, that those who are made eunuchs by the hands of men, and then those who are eunuchs for the kingdom of Christ that have that singular focus to serve Christ, there are those who have been made eunuchs at the hands of men with the transgender movement. And we need to continue to minister to those who have been made eunuchs by men with compassion and care. And there's a sense in which maybe this is particularly true for the Reformed Church, or at least portions of the Reformed Church, that we tend to think of the world as opposition, as war, as the military front, as a minefield, when the world is mission. The world is witness, evangelize, rescue. That we're not seeking to attack those who have been attacked by this militant ideology, this predatory ideology. Our mission is rescue, right? Not attack, kill, and dominion. No, rescue and save as Christ came to seek and save the lost. And we need to not forget that. Our battle is not against flesh and blood. We want to rescue flesh and blood. Our battle is against the spiritual authorities that are advancing this wicked satanic agenda in our world. And then some final pastoral thoughts as we bring this to conclusion. Pray for conversions. Those who have had such an ideology inflicted upon them, we have our Rosaria Butterfield from the homosexual agenda, that the Lord delivered Rosaria out of such a community and out of such an ideology. We should expect more Rosarias. We should be praying for more Rosarias, but out of the transgender movement, not just the homosexual movement. And when we pray for conversions, we shouldn't be surprised if the Lord answers. And also, if we're willing to pray and by faith expect that the Lord would bring conversions, then we need to be willing to have conversations as well. It's not as though they are other and we can't have conversations with those who might find themselves buying into such a mindset or being preyed upon by such a mindset. So have wise, nuanced, shepherding conversations with those who might find themselves in those ways of thinking. For parents or grandparents whose children are being preyed upon by this ideology, we need to care for them. We need to care for, well, I mentioned the very first week that there's an RP church where the pastor reached out to the counseling center and said, we have one in our membership who's thinking of transitioning. What help is there? And so how can we help parents and grandparents and those themselves who are thinking about transitioning? I wrote an article for the Biblical Counseling Coalition on this very topic. How do we help parents whose children are considering transition? And really, the number one recommendation, I mean, there's more than just this, like, you know, prayer and, you know, ordinary means and so forth and counsel. But the number one solution, even secularists are recognizing this, if you want to rescue people from transitioning, get them out of the environment that is affirming the transition, or get them out of the environment that is cheering it onward, right? Or offering it as a possibility. Even the book that I mentioned by Abigail Schreier in the first week, again, just a straight secularist who's an honest journalist, she says, the only parents who were able to salvage their children from not transitioning were those who entirely uprooted their children from the community that was affirming transition. Those were the only ones that were successful. So removing, you know, the children from such an environment of schools or therapists or doctors or whatever who are affirming such. And then provide counsel to those who are tempted. As we were talking about last week, we also need to cast a positive biblical vision for gender, that the Lord has made us male and female by design, and this is good, and that our response is not a pendulum stereotypical response. You see that in some quarters in the Reformed Church. Well, what we need is machismo, and what we need is like hyperfeminism or some, or femininity or something. No. We need a positive biblical vision, not stereotypical response as a pendulum swing back to an enculturated perspective or something. No. It's the culture of the Scriptures. It's the culture of Christ, right, that transcends all cultures. Be the church. As Rosaria talked about in many of her books, really, in the homosexual movement, there's a real community in the homosexual community that she was losing, and the church needed to be the community that she was losing from the homosexual community. Well, the same is true for the transgender community. So long as you're like in the group, you're in. You're like in like Flint, like we will, you know, bleed and die with you kind of thing, right? But then once you break rank, then you lose that community and they're against you. And the church needs to be that true community that people are longing for. We are designed for community, and people are going to find that community one way or another, and they need to not find it in the trans community, but find it in the Church of Jesus Christ. And so we need to be mindful of those at-risk populations and provide godly community that the church is. And then I don't mean this as a bleak statement, but I think it's helpful to just recognize the train ain't going back in the station, the toothpaste isn't going back in the tube. And like just recognizing that is actually helpful in the sense that it won't cause us to be focused on the wrong battlefront of, oh, if we like we're anxious, if we only stand here, then we can preserve the culture. Again, the battlefront is the gospel, is continuing to hold out Christ, and we don't want to get off message, and the church can't get off message by whatever the current battlefront is of the week. And for those of you who know loved ones or know loved ones who are tempted with this or are transitioning or have transitioned, we cannot forget that these three remain: faith, hope, and love, and the greatest of these is love. We cannot forget love, and that is what we will be marked as Christ's disciples. They will know that we are his disciples by our love, and so we need to continue to hold out that hope, that rescue, that community, that gospel that is love. And I know that there is a mentality in the church of, well, we just cut those people off. And you're cutting them off from the hope of the gospel and the love of Christ. And I don't think that that is what we ought to do. Now, I'm not speaking against the proper place of church discipline in those circumstances. Of course, there's the rightful place of church discipline. But even that is offered in love.